Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today it's going to be a super fun episode. Mr. Money Mustache does not need an introduction, so I'm going to skip it. Pete, welcome today. How are you doing?
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be back in your basement, one of my favorite destinations in Longmont.
So you turned 50 here recently, and you hit 19 years of retirement. You did an interview with AARP, which I assume was your goal the whole time, is just to be featured in AARP at some point. Did they contact you or did you reach out to them?
They contacted me. And so first of all, the secret is I'm not quite 50 yet, but I stretched my birthday a bit just because I like to keep people guessing. When you're, mm-hmm. You don't want to put too much of your personal information online, but I'm very close to 50. And yeah, apparently I've been in an interview with AARP many, many years ago, like just a super short one that I didn't even remember. So they reached back out and they said, hey, we would love to feature you now that you're officially AARP eligibility age. And I said, okay, yeah, that sounds like a fun thing to do.
Are you a member of AARP, by the way?
No, but of course I'm gonna be signing up now. Maybe I can weasel a free membership in exchange for that interview.
You get great discounts, but it's also really cheap, so people can check it out. This is not sponsored by AARP, but anyway.
Yeah, it is good. Probably a good deal if you use the discounts that they have hooked up for you.
And I read the digital version, and we'll link up to it so people can check it out. It's a nice interview, good photo shoot. But I'm told that the print version of this has some kind of a centerfold pictorial. Is that true?
Well, who told you that? I don't know if the print version is out yet. I don't know if my feature is going to be in it. I hope so, because I think some of the pictures are good, but
I don't know. Yeah, we'll try to hunt it down and people look and actually ask people about that. So anyway, one of the things when we were brainstorming this was about some of the topics that sort of typical retired people who are older, usually, what they think about, and then what FIRE people think about and the things that we're concerned about. So you highlighted a couple of the themes from like traditional retirees, and you sent over a couple articles, some headlines from AARP. So you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think it really depends just on the path of your life and your age. So I did a little bit of reading of AARP articles just to see what type of things their typical readers are interested in. And it's stuff like how to find your car in a parking lot if using your smartphone or something like that. And, you know, certain things are changing in the Medicare program. Should you be concerned? And so it makes sense. But of course, if you're in a different stage of life, like the FIRE community, a lot of us are retiring in our 30s and 40s. So we're more concerned about stuff like parenting and school stuff, and health and fitness is probably a little bit more in style among younger generations than in my parents' generation. It wasn't quite as much of a thing. So I think in our FIRE community, for example, you'll see a lot of people who are into like all the health podcasts and books and experiments with nutrition and training and stuff like that. So it's nice to have, you know, the junior retirement community still exploring issues that are more interesting to our age group.
We are thinking about like values and happiness. I mean, I think Carl and I, like most of the time, our conversations end up like heading towards happiness or lifestyle and just like time optimization. But it's interesting. So we're talking optimization, and usually us FIRE folks, we're really good at optimizing, maybe too good. We get obsessed with it, and then it manifests later where it's like maybe a little harder to spend money sometimes. And we're like trying to optimize when we don't need to. We actually need to de-optimize so we could chill the fuck out and just relax a little bit. And, you know, another topic is sort of like spending for values and community, right?
Yeah.
So I mentioned like four or five things where it's like happiness, de-optimizing, values, and community. Do you have anyone you want to dig into a little bit deeper here?
Yeah. Hey, that's a really good point. And I'd like to amend my form previous answer, I guess, because you're right that, okay, there seems to be currently a movement, which I think is really, really great, where everybody's looking into what happiness really is and trying to be more purposeful and understand your emotions instead of just going through and saying like, I want more travel or I want more luxury or whatever, like the things that we default to thinking what happiness is. And most people in previous generations, I think you just kind of stumble around some things you enjoy, some things you don't, but you're not really being purposeful about it. Whereas if you start out at the beginning and saying like, okay, instead of just trying out, you know, boat ownership or luxury cruising or whatever, like let's dig into like psychology and see what human happiness is really about. And being, you know, then I think your choices will be a little bit different. And one of your examples, which is saving and accumulating a whole bunch of money, that's definitely not a great thing to just pursue for your whole life, thinking that's going to make you happy. I like the idea of money being a tool to get you your freedom, but then after that, you should really make sure that you're not just continuing to follow that old behavior and just keep stashing and accumulating. And that's been a big thing in the FIRE community this year, especially with Carl and Mindy and Ramit and the Mad Scientist. Everybody's talking about spending and are you good at spending or are you still being cheap with yourself? And I've been experimenting with that myself. And I'm really glad that this is something that's now part of the dialogue a lot more, because I think it's going to make everybody a bit better to just let go of the scarcity mentality. And yeah, I think I meandered a little bit.
No, that it's perfect. And I think it's so tough because like the fact that we were saving and optimizing and being efficient, which a lot of us are engineers, not everyone, but we do, you know, we don't like to see waste. Yeah. So once we get that sort of habit dialed in and it's worked for us and we got what we wanted, but now it's like, you have to reverse it. So there's definitely some like retraining and you have to look at things from a different perspective. So, okay. Tons here, but we should probably keep moving on here. One other thing that you mentioned is just like the health and fitness aspect. And there's been a couple, we don't see each other like every week or anything, but there were a couple stretches where I didn't see you. And I think maybe when some of us went down to the Phoenix area to cul-de-sac, which we'll talk about later, I was like, dude, what are you doing? You're jacked. So you want to talk a little bit about your fitness routine currently and maybe how it's changed over the last year or so?
Well, I've always been into this stuff since I was a little kid, you know, and just, I thought I wanted to be a big, strong man. So I had like many young people of that era, and you watch the action figure movies and, you know, the Arnold movies and everything, and like it kind of inspires stuff. So that was like always the background. And then later I got into it for better reasons, I think, which is you're getting older and you want to maintain functionality and not have a bunch of health problems that are self-imposed. So I've always, you know, biked and weight trained and walked and everything like that. And I think I just decided over the last year to make it a bit of a higher priority instead of just like putting workouts at the end of the list of daily activities. I kind of put it at a higher priority and said, well, it doesn't matter if you get your other tasks done, the workout is the most important. And then also when I was living in this cul-de-sac, the neighborhood that's named cul-de-sac in Arizona, which we can talk about later, they had a really good gym on site and I had like maybe a bit less interesting social life than I do here in Longmont. So it made it even easier to just walk over to the next building and do these great huge workouts every day. And then, you know, just eat really well at the same time. And then that has stuck ever since. And because I also have a gym at my house in the garage and it's really good. And yeah, I think just making it a higher priority is especially good the older you get. And that's one change that I'm glad I did.
Okay. And then a couple of very specific questions, like how many days per week do you work out and do you log everything? Do you track and make sure you're making progress?
Well, the answer to the first one is every day, like just 7 days a week, do some weights, because I find as soon as I take a day off, then I kind of forget and it's easier to just do it every day. Even if you have to scale back in order for the body to be able to keep up with recovery, it's better to do a smaller workout every day and just work your way through the body parts instead of saying, no, I only work out 3 days a week and then I work out harder. And then I don't have, you know, like specific goals and program, and maybe I should, but I just have a journal on the desk that's in my garage that's next to the weights where I write down what I did. That encouraged me to do more because I could say like, oh yeah, I want to be able to write down the big numbers of working hard, and I give myself lots of exclamation marks.
Okay.
And like thumbs ups and stuff. And as long as I do it consistently, then, you know, I do a good job and work hard.
Okay. And then final question around this, we could do a whole show on this too, but your protein intake. So a lot of it is around diet. So you're working out hard, you're consistent, you enjoy it, you're in the gym, you know, pretty much every day. What does your diet look like?
I think it's just the pretty basic whole foods diet. So an omnivore, and I try to eat as much protein as I can in a practical sense, which still ends up being just the recommended amount, which is like 1 gram per body weight pound. So but basically for me, it's like 185 grams of protein a day is my rough guideline. So I just pretty much eat as much protein whenever I can. Like that includes yogurt with protein powder, like mixed in there, plain yogurt, because otherwise the numbers just won't be high enough.
Right.
And, you know, like occasional, lots of chicken breasts and lots of like grilled stuff. I kind of grill every day.
Okay. Got it. Okay. Let's move on to some of the retirement stuff. So you have been retired for 19 years. You retired just before your 30th birthday.
Just before my 31st birthday.
So 31st. 30, okay.
Then, which 30, is why okay. it's 19 years rather than 20.
Okay. So long time. You've definitely been retired longer than you were working, right? So do you have any specific reflections on being retired, especially at such an early age where basically none of your peers were doing that? They thought you were crazy for the most part.
That part is true. Yeah. I think it's definitely the best thing that I ever did in my life. Well, that and moving to the US in the first place, which is something I did when I was 24 years old. And it was quite a leap for me because I moved here by myself. And that turned out to be amazing from Canada, because I think my life has been a lot better here in Colorado than it would have been in Ontario. And then the second best thing I ever did, you know, which allowed me to do so many other things better, is just, yeah, quitting the job and having the freedom to start a family. You know, my job as a dad, which has been amazing. The only reason it was so amazing is because I was able to put it first instead of having my career as a sort of like competitor to my child raising job. So that's the thing I'm always going to be the most proud of, probably, you know, until I die. I'm going to be like, I'm so glad that I retired and I was able to do the best job I could as a dad. But then there's a lot of stuff that's for me too, that I've been able to do. Like the whole idea of never having to compromise on your health and fitness because you don't have the job sucking away your time has been amazing. And so many family vacations and like personal vacations in the last 6 years, you know, like everything has been made better by the extra free time that I have. And I still like working too. You know, I've done a lot of little businesses and tons of construction. So it's not like I'm just laying around with my retirement, but I just love the free time because it gives me more chance to express my own creativity.
And that's a piece that we hear all the time. People are like, I don't want to retire. I like my job, which, you know, they're extremely lucky and they're also rare. Like most people don't like their job. But that is one of the objections people have. And I think we know that, right? Like we need to work and be productive. Like we like to do things and create things. So can you talk about some of your creative projects, whether you classify them as work or if it's a more of a hobby type thing? And, you know, you could talk about recent things or stuff from 10 or 15 years ago, kind of wide open for you.
Yeah. Well, it's been a meandering path because I didn't always know exactly what I was going to want to do. So I tried some things and they weren't fun. Like one of my early things is I started an actual construction company with a friend where we were building brand new houses because we both liked construction and design and stuff. And that turned out to be even worse than the job I had just retired from because it was really stressful and you're managing like permits and rules and contractors and insurance and all this stuff. So I was like, okay. Failed experiment, but there's no such thing as a failed experiment because I just learned what I prefer. And ever since then, I kept the part that I do like, which is construction and carpentry and design, but I did it without the company and the big, you know, overhead of making entire houses. So I just work on renovating houses for myself or for friends, or sometimes we've done pretty major stuff like building entire new places, but it was kind of like out of an existing house. So I didn't have to deal with the parts that I didn't like. And so that's been really great. And of course, becoming a blogger is one example. There's a child raising thing that I mentioned that's probably the biggest. And most recently, since 2017, is co-managing the headquarters co-working space with Carl, our mutual friend, and Mindy and our other friend Bill. Like that part has been a super random, like silly. We just did it on a whim, but it turned out to be one of the best things that I ever did. And I never would have tried that while also having a job because I would have thought it would be too stressful. And for me, it would be. I'm very much like a single tasker. not a multitasker. So I like to have enough space to do the things that I'm committed to and not overcommit.
What's so great about the co-working space?
Well, the co-working space is great because it's become a friend harvesting machine, which is what I joked about it was going to be when I first started it. But it's just a really, really great way for everybody who's a member to just meet a bunch of new people and get closer and closer to them. And I love when people are friends, you know, like without even me being involved. Like, I just love to hear that people met at the HQ, or, you know, that there's an event there that I didn't plan just because it has a life of its own. Or, you know, for example, I'm involved in a little music group now. It's a jazz trio where I'm getting to play bass with a friend who's an amazing piano player and our other friend who's an everything player, but he's doing the drums for our trio. And so we're practicing a couple songs that we're going to, you know, present at an upcoming party at the headquarters. So all that stuff is examples of why having a community group. The headquarters is disguised, you know, it's labeled as a co-working space, but it's really more of a social club that just has the option to work there during the day as well.
Okay. Yeah. And I was going to say, I met most of my friends there at the co-working space. So thanks for putting it together.
And thank you for, same thing. Like, it's really, really valuable. And the caliber of people that show up there is just really nice. And yeah, I really have no complaints, and we just got to keep it going, and it gets a little bit better each year, and that's also great.
So you mentioned the construction company, and I mean, well, that was a full-time job, basically, I suspect, right? Because we're building houses and doing stuff.
Well, it was part-time because I already had our baby was born.
Okay.
Who's now an 18-year-old, but so I'm obviously not going to prioritize this hobby business over child raising, but I still felt like it was pulling me away, and that's why it wasn't compatible with my retirement.
Got it. So kind of related. So you operated with the 4% rule when you retired. You were like, okay, we have enough. You know, we could retire from our jobs. Have you had to tap into your retirement savings? And you could sort of mention, in 2008, you had the newly built house from the construction company, but you couldn't sell it. If people remember, the market was a little bit in trouble back then.
Yeah.
And you rented it out for a while. So you were kind of in a much different situation than you probably expected a couple years before. So have you tapped into, you know, your retirement savings and used and executed the 4%?
Yeah. Although it was very chaotic and not all that organized. So first of all, during those early years of retirement, before I was a retirement blogger, I didn't really know about the 4% rule by that name. I just kind of thought a fixed amount of investments should be able to fund your lifestyle, and we probably have enough. Turns out we were roughly following the 4% rule without realizing it. But then, in order to start the construction company, I actually sold a bunch of my index funds and used them to pay for the construction of this house. So it was like transferring assets from one category to another. Mm-hmm. And then the idea is we would sell the house and make a profit, and then I would put it back into the index funds. But for a while during the housing crash, I was forced to rent out that house instead. It was actually the second house we built. But so anyway, it was a different form of the 4% rule, because we had a house that was worth, like, let's say $500,000 at the time. And I was renting it out for $2,500 a month, which I think is $30,000 a year of income. So that was like a 6%, which isn't a very good ratio, but it was still 6% of the capital was coming back to us in the form of income. And we were living off that for a number of years. So it was still a different form of retirement living, but it was just wasn't the one I chose because it was like a little more stressful. And then we've had my former wife and I, we both had part-time jobs at different times. Like, she used to work and, you know, do some accounting and marketing work sometimes. And, you know, this is the thing that happens with a lot of people's retirements, though, early retirements especially, is like you just try a bunch of different things. And very few people are just like, okay, I quit. Let's turn on the income stream from the 4% rule. And then I'm just going to sit back and watch the checks come in, right? It's very rare that people are dynamic enough to retire early, but then so sedentary that they're not doing a bunch of cool stuff with their life afterwards. So, you know, the 4% rule, I often say, is just a guideline to give you the courage to quit your job. And then you go ahead and live your life and then see what happens.
Okay. You were on the Tim Ferriss podcast in 2017. And I think the title was something like living on 25 to 27,000 per year. And of course, you know, that was a few years ago, inflation would make that more. Can you tell us what your expenses are now in 2024?
The funny part is, the answer is yes. So normally I don't track my spending. I tell blog readers to track their spending when they're trying to figure things out initially. But afterwards, because I know there's plenty, I don't do it. However, I just went back and redid it. So I added up all my expenses for the past year. I just happened to do that a couple weeks ago. My spending has dropped, even though I'm trying to spend more. I'm getting ridiculous with like my car, you know, I have a nice car now and spend more on restaurants and travel.
Yeah.
But even so, I added it all up. And in the past 12 months, my personal spending was only $18,000 instead of like the 25 to 27 we used to spend. Now that used to be a household of two parents and a child, right? So now we have two separate households because we're not married. And so I'm just responsible for mine. My house is a little smaller now, but it still surprised me. You know, I thought I'd be like in the 30,000 range.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you include all my business spending, because I have the business that owns the blog and the construction company. And then I went through all that and there's like an additional $9,000 that's debatable. That's like benefits me. Like, for example, I love construction. My construction company buys all the tools so I can do construction. So there's several thousand dollars of that. So that was about $9,000, including the business related travel and other things. So if you really, really add everything up in the most pessimistic way, then maybe my spending is like $27,000 these days. But that includes property taxes. And like, actually I have my spreadsheet open here. I'll just read out a couple things just because they surprised me. So when I sum it up, my restaurant spending was like a full half of my grocery spending. It was like $6,000 on groceries for me and my son, $2,500 for just restaurants, $6,000 for travel.
Wow.
And then my utilities, $2,000, another $3,500 for Amazon stuff, which is probably like gadgets and tools and construction materials, some of it. And then $3,500 is my health insurance premiums, which is like a direct primary care doctor, and then this Sidera health share thing, which is like a catastrophic health insurance alternative. And then my car was actually quite a bit because I had overpriced insurance for the past year, which I've since fixed. So that was like $3,200 on car expenses.
Okay.
Even though I don't have to pay for gasoline, it's still added up. So it's kind of funny how even with this crazy stuff, I still ended up under $30,000.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like enough, but
I'm trying, man.
But
I'm,
you seem happy. Yeah.
I'm getting ridiculous.
So, side question. So you bought a Tesla in the last couple years. People could read the blog article and check out the craziness of the internet and the comments there. But that's another story for another time. So you obviously spent money on the car. So how do you factor that into your expenses? Do you like spread that out over several years? Because it was what? Like you got some good cash or the tax rebates, but it's still like $30,000-$40,000, right?
Yeah. If you include all the, like the tax, sales tax on the car, but then subtract the tax credits, I still spent like $45,000 on that car. That was more than 12 months ago. So it didn't show up in this spending. So really what you should probably do is count the depreciation of the car each year as my spending on the car. So really, I guess you'd add probably like a $3,000, you know, $3,000 to $5,000. Because the car is so new, it's in its fast depreciation stage.
Right.
So that's a good point.
Okay. Yeah. Obviously, like.
And if I had borrowed money for the car, then there would be like a car loan and the interest portion of that and the depreciation would be part of your budget. So yeah, I'm spending a little more because of having a nice car. I definitely agree.
And let's talk a little bit more about spending. Mad scientist Brandon has talked about like trying to spend more. I think Ramit was on his show or vice versa. And they talked about just like spending more money. And it's like, I've hung out with you. Like you spend money. You're not like holding back on anything. Is there anything where you're like, I could, or I want to try to experiment to spend more money on this to see if I do like it?
Yeah. Well, I've already done that. Like anytime I want something, as long as I genuinely want it, I will purchase that item and like, you know, lots of vacations with friends and, you know, anything related to like dating or nice dinners with friends or whatever, there would be no holding back in that department either. And I even pay to get the better plane seats, you know, like I pay for those upgrades so I don't have to sit in row like seat 99B or whatever.
Right.
You know, I don't mind spending like an extra $100 round trip to sit near the front of the plane. So that's all been good. That's increased my spending by a few thousand a year. Feels great. The only thing, the next frontier is potentially a bigger house. I mean, my house actually has almost everything you need. So I only need a bit more workshop space and maybe a music room, which would be a stretch. But, you know, if a nice house right in my neighborhood came up for sale, I would consider spending money to upgrade that. And then, but even better, I'd actually prefer to have a co-owned thing, just like we do with the headquarters, where friends and I get together to buy like a nice mountain property with like a stream running through it, and then have a lodge on there and some cabins and spend lots of time up there with summers and, you know, in the summers, and have friends and kids and campfires and all that. Yeah. And that's a good way to spend more money, because you can spend like $1 million or more on a nice piece of mountain resort real estate.
And there's such nice places within just, you know, less than an hour, but if you go like a couple hours out, like there's some really awesome, like you get away from the heat in the summer. And then if you're into like winter sport activities, like you can ski or snowboard or snowshoe or whatever. Do you ski and do you do any winter activities? Or?
Yeah. Like I'm a snowboarder, but my favorite is really the mountain biking. So for me, the mountain place would be a summer retreat. Okay. And then I would rather, I'll still go there and crunch around in the snow, but I think I'd rather go somewhere warm for the winters. And that's another way to spend more money, is I was thinking of renting just like a seasonal rental. I don't need to own a beach house, but I would like to own a place or have access to a place somewhere warm to spend the winters.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
you're Canadian though. What are you talking? Yeah. I thought you're just natural. Like, don't you like the cold weather?
No, Canadians hate the cold weather. And that's why those of us who can afford it, go, I mean, typically to Florida, because that's exotic to Canadians. They're like, oh my God, you got to go to Florida? That's so cool, eh? But yeah, anywhere. I had a great time being in the Phoenix area last winter, and I really, really enjoyed the weather there. And that taught me that there's just no need to endure winter if you don't have to.
Yeah. Yeah, we've thought about it too, to just like get... rent a house for like a month or 6 weeks, like in San Diego or something like that, and just get out for the coldest part of the winter, and then get somebody to shovel the snow, the occasional snow that we get. It's usually not too much, and then it just melts away.
So. Yeah, right. And then what I realized, though, being away from our friend group last winter, is that I was really craving, every time I came back here from Phoenix, which is once a month last winter, I just had such a good time seeing everybody again. And I was sad to have to go back, even though the weather is so much nicer in Arizona. So I'm going to stick around this winter and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And it's to be determined, like the long-term old man winter plan.
Yeah.
I mean, the ideal would be to set something up where the friends can come and spend a lot of time there, like rent a really big house in San Diego, for example.
Right.
And then we could all have access to it.
People come and go.
Yeah.
That would work pretty well. Okay. So we have a bunch of questions from the Facebook group. So we'll kind of hit those. And if people want to check out the Facebook group, it's at milehighfi.com/Facebook. And then that should redirect. And then I think I have to approve you or something. So no spammers out there. All right. So this question's from Sam. What advice would you give to a young adult today that wants to retire early? Maybe there's different obstacles than when you were coming up. And just any tips. I mean, I think a lot of the principles hold true, but things are a little bit different now. So what advice would you give a young person?
Yeah, well, congratulations, because if Sam is thinking about this already, that's really all the battle that you've already won. I mean, the biggest thing that we get as fire writers and podcasters is a lot of people are like, I wish I had discovered this when I was in my 20s, because then I'd already be retired. I don't really think anything has changed since I did this in the 1990s and 2000s, or since I started writing about it in 2011, like the same idea is just there, which is earn your paycheck, try to increase your income if you can, you know, do a good job at your job, and then just don't blow all the proceeds from what is probably a pretty good salary, and just streamline your life, like make sure your vehicle choices are reasonable, live close to work, ride a bike, don't spend a ton on, you know, $15 martinis after work. And it's just by changing the default American mentality, which is extreme inefficiency, it's pretty easy to cut your spending by half without even having your lifestyle look all that different. It's only when you're trying to cut by 90% or something that things really look extreme, you know, and you're living in a trailer and, you know, just entirely dumpster diving type stuff, which you don't have to do. I mean, you can do it if it's fun, but you shouldn't do it if it's not fun. You should just go for like the middle class with some thoughtful spending. And that's the American dream, I think, because in this country, the incomes are high, the necessities are cheap. And then beyond that, you can spend as much as you want. So it's kind of like a really nice free, you have a lot of options here.
One thing is sort of like the place you choose to live, right? So the cost of living can have a huge impact. And there's some, I forget which podcaster I'm thinking of, but they're like, when you're early in your career, go to big cities. I think it might be Scott Galloway. So he's like, go to big cities, like there's more opportunities there, but it's often more expensive. And like, you can't afford to live like downtown. So you have to live in a suburb and then you get a car and then like it's a snowball effect.
Yeah.
So yeah. What advice do you have for someone where it's like I can get this good job, but it's in the Bay Area and it's like super expensive versus like other options. Like how would you face that?
Well, when you do the math on those things, I think the real problem is people are not typing some shit into a spreadsheet, which they should be doing. And Scott Galloway's point is good, I think, because when you look at the Bay Area job, San Francisco Bay, for those who don't know the lingo, the pay is so high there sometimes that it more than makes up for the difference in rent. So if you're like in the cheapest city, you know, Oklahoma, small town, you might be able to rent your apartment for like $1,000 a month. And then that same apartment in, you know, right close to the Google headquarters or wherever your job is going to be $4,000 or $5,000 a month. So that's a difference of about $50,000 a year. You know, that's the moat between the two most extreme rental markets in the whole country. So as long as your pay is $50,000 or higher, which to be honest, I mean, sometimes it is like a new grad computer engineer starts at like $150,000, $200,000 in an in-demand field. And if you're comparing that to a job where you only make 50, well, that's a huge difference. So you pay the difference in the rent. And I'm not even talking about roommates. If you can have roommates, that cuts your rent in half again. And then you still have like many, many tens of thousands or even hundred thousands of dollars of difference in order to be able, which you can invest and build up a huge, you know, stash and retire early. And then it's up to you. Like you might have such a high income that you can still stay in the Bay Area and afford to pay that rent forever, or spend the $3 million it costs for a house or whatever.
Okay.
So yeah, it's crazy that the incomes go very high in the US, but yeah. Usually you're not saving money by commuting 45 minutes each way. A lot of people think, oh yeah, my rent is $500 cheaper and my gas is only like $250. That's like terrible math, because you're actually spending much, much more than that if you value your time and your health and even just the car costs. So that's the main thing. Commuting is usually a money loser.
Yeah. Commuting is horrible. I couldn't imagine. Next question from Neil. Congratulations on becoming an empty nester. What are you most looking forward to in this new phase of life?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm not really an empty nester yet, because our son still splits his time between the two parent houses. We live right in the neighborhood, the same neighborhood. But it's getting easier and easier, right? Because he likes to be more independent and you can go away. And the kid's not going to starve because he needs to be fed or anything like that, like that would be the case with a young child. So I've already been doing more and more things, you know, like getting out and having more trips. And we've been changing our co-parenting schedule, where it's more like we just have this adult, wonderful roommate who hangs out in his apartments at the two homes. And he's working on, you know, eventually, of course, he will move out. But it's already great. You know, I just have more free time and I love having my son around, because he's great company as well. So I've just traveled more and now I'm allowed to have, I let myself have friends over as much as I want. And I know it's not going to make me a worse parent, because it's not like he needs me
right.
to be attending to him.
Perfect. Next is from Kang. What is something new you've tried recently that you would recommend to others? And it could be an experience, task, habit, whatever.
That's a tricky one, because I feel like I've, as a 19 years retired person, I've already been trying to do everything that I could think of. But there's a one that we talked about before the show started, which is retreats with friends. Doug and I were both on what I called the men's mountain retreat that one of our other friends put together. I guess I can say who it was, right?
Yep.
It was actually Brad Barrett, the Choose FI guy, invited a bunch of friends and rented this condo in Breckenridge. And then we all just went up there for most of a week, I guess, and mm-hmm. did a bunch of mountain stuff like mountain biking and hiking a 14er, pickleball, a bunch of pickleball.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really fun to catch up with everybody. And it felt really special. So I kind of want to do that more. And I want to be the instigator where I will just rent a nice place and invite, you know, good friends. And if you do it early enough with enough advance notice, people tend to say yes, because they would love to just, they love when someone does the planning for them. And then it's a really great way to catch up with your friends.
Yeah, it was so fun. And thanks to Brad for putting it together. We met some new people, so not everyone knew each other. And one cool thing, like, I was actually a little concerned about like going out to eat all the time. Just it's typically unhealthy. And if they're trying to turn the table in a town like Breckenridge, it's like not as fun. We ended up eating like 90% of the meals in. Someone was sort of in charge of dinner and for each night, and we kind of traded off. It was just the people that like wanted to cook the food. But it ended up being awesome because, you know, a couple people would have a drink or something like that. We often had like a discussion topic, and then we would have like great food, tons of protein. We were all like lots of protein and veggies. So it was just like meat and veggies all the time. It was super cool. Really fun.
And actually we were lucky to have a chef in our midst as well, who was like just making these incredible multi-course meals for us. So shout out to Steven.
Yeah, Steven did great.
And actually Doug brought amazing food too. So that helps too. Yeah, I definitely would include that factor. And, you know, if you have a big enough budget, you could even hire, like, have catering. Like, it could just be normal DoorDash stuff, just to make it easier to facilitate your group having fun and not having to wait at restaurants just to get fed.
Right.
But also just bringing a lot of groceries and stocking the fridge in your rental house.
Yeah.
That goes a long way towards taking the edge off of that typical vacation.
And yeah, I was going to say, one, it worked out fine. But I was going to say the specific kitchen that we had, like, it made it more difficult to do dishes. So it's like, that is one pro of like having like either some catering come in at least for a couple meals, because then cleanup's kind of taken care of. But everyone like pitched in, and it was like, you know, you do dishes one day. Like if you cooked, you didn't do dishes. And
yeah,
it all worked out fine.
Right. So. I mean, our rental condo was a little bit below the not befitting of gentlemen of our status. So I'm going to suggest that we go upmarket a bit next time, get something a bit fancier.
It was a great test. Like we could optimize certain areas, like a couple extra bathrooms and stuff like that. But somehow we all share the bathrooms
instead of a condo. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
yeah. Like that was, I'm just joking around. Like obviously we're super grateful to Brad and for planning it, but he was operating on a short, he found like everything was already rented and,
right.
The important part is being together more than exactly where your rental is. So he wanted to be right in downtown Breckenridge. But now that I saw the layout, it'd be better to be like a few blocks out. And then perhaps there's more house rentals out there or whatever. But anyway, we're getting on a side tangent. But the main point is retreats with your friends. Like it's a really good idea. Good idea to create warm memories in your life.
Next topic is sleep. One of my favorite things. And this little segment sponsored by Ghostbed. So Ghostbed, they've been great partners. They have mattresses, they have sheets, they have bed frames and like a split king situation. A lot of good stuff. But we're going to talk about sleep. And this question is from Rich. What is your sleep routine and are you a good sleeper?
Yeah, I'm really lucky, I think, because I've heard about most people don't really sleep all the way through the night and they have trouble falling asleep or getting enough hours. And I just zonk out, you know. And then I wake up when the birds are tweeting and I go to bed early, like before 10 o'clock usually.
Okay.
I did read these books like from The Sleep Diplomat. Matt Walker is a good example. There's a lot of stuff people do that are bad for their sleep. So as long as you learn those things, like don't watch TV past 7 p.m., don't eat past 7 p.m., a bunch of stuff like that, then sleep becomes easier. And don't do anything particularly exciting. Just let your whole system wind down. You know, have the lights in your house dim, and then your body kind of just takes over after that. And then as you get up the next day, make sure you set your clock, your biological clock appropriately, like get out into the sunlight, and then your sleep will be fine from, at least from the body perspective. I know that the mattress company is going to have some opinions on, like, well, being comfortable is another factor, right?
Yeah. And I'm going to force you before you leave to lay on a ghost bed, but you don't have to say any opinions about it, but you're going to check it out. So one thing that I started doing, and I think you do this as well, I started wearing an eye mask critical in the summer. Like, now we're in the fall and the days are shorter, so it's not as important. But do you wear a sleep mask?
Oh yeah, I forgot. I definitely do all that stuff too, because I'm very easy to wake up. So I like to be in a complete, you know, princess bubble. I have the full eye mask and I put earplugs in. Even if I'm in a perfectly dark, silent place, I still do that, just because psychologically my body knows that I'm not going to be interrupted. So therefore it's not worried about waking up, and therefore I don't wake up and I fall asleep more quickly. So it's like maybe a little bit high maintenance, but well, since I have the option, I just use those things, and it definitely helps, because yeah, you don't even want like any light hitting your eyelids when you're asleep. And the best thing is about early retirement is you're also never using an alarm clock to wake up. And even people with jobs should be careful about this. You need to change your sleep schedule so that you go to bed early enough, so that you wake up early enough, so that you never use an alarm clock. That's the most evil,
yeah,
terrible invention. Like, why would you take the most important bodily function, which is sleep, and then cut it off artificially?
Right.
Like, that's the stupidest idea. That's just like injecting a little bit of poison as your way, you know, yeah, every day.
This reminds me to the Breckenridge. We had a little argument, Pete.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember this? So
I do.
We're going to hike a 14er the next day. It's called Quandary. And I was like, from a mountaineering standpoint, we need to get it out there early so we can get down early. I think we should wake up at fucking whatever. I was like 4 o'clock. We should leave at 5. We should be hiking in the dark. And what was your response?
My response was no. And it's because a hike is supposed to be fun. And what's the point of like doing something not fun in order to have fun?
Yeah.
And or destroying the fun of the activity. And then of course we got lucky. First of all, we were really close to the mountain, so we didn't have to like travel far to get there. So there's no need to start that early. And when you look up at the specs of the mountain, it wasn't that long of a climb. So all you need to do is be off the mountain before noon to avoid thunderstorms. So when you do the math, there's no need to start that hike at 5 o'clock in the morning.
And through some heated debate, we worked it out, and I was like, "Hey, you know what? You're right, Pete. You're right about that." And it turned out you were even more right, because it was rainy that morning. So if we started early, we would have been like cold and wet, and it would have been a horrible day. But we started the bright when the clouds broke and the sun came out, and it was beautiful. And I was like, "You were right, man. Like you nailed it."
Well, that
you
part, nailed it. The rain part was obviously just dumb luck. But yeah, we came across some sullen people who had started too early, and they're like, "We didn't go to the top because it was too rainy."
Yeah.
And we just had beautiful clear weather for our hike. Oh, I was very grateful for that. But yeah, the lesson in this, folks, is don't use an alarm clock. And if that's not possible for you, then change your life until it is possible, because alarm clocks are not acceptable.
So thanks to Ghostbed, they have a 101 night at home sleep trial. So you could check it out and see if you like the mattress, and then, you know, figure out what to do if you don't for some reason. They have many different mattresses. You can save 50% with the code MILEHIFI at checkout. So as we're wrapping up, we'll kind of do some rapid fire, because we have quite a few questions left. So we have Katie, who is at Camp Fi that we were at earlier this year. And you mentioned that you consulted with someone who wanted you to review their retirement plan. So have you done more of these consultations, and what have you learned from the experience, if so?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So just to fill in the listeners here, I tried one paid coaching session, just because I've never done anything, you know, in that sense. I always just did free advice or blog articles that are like a case study. So I accepted one, like, I guess you could say client, and it was this guy who gave me his full financial details and asked, like, am I on track to retire and should I make any changes? And I found that to be really, really fun. And I would like to do it again, not so I can make money, but just so it can, because it feels useful to like just kind of really dig into it with somebody. So I would still charge like a nominal fee for it and maybe do one every month or two, because it feels meaningful and it's like a human connection for me. And what I realized, like the stuff that I know and the way I think about early retirement and stuff, to me, it seems really obvious. And like, how could this be useful to anybody? It's so obvious. But the more people I work through their situation, the more I realize that, yeah, maybe I do have something to offer, because like the big soup of numbers, like I can pull it apart and make it simple and then give it back to the person and we talk it over, then they're like, oh, well, thank you. I didn't realize it was so simple. So to me, it's nice to know that I have that skill that is kind of rare and I want to use it more and help, you know, it's really fun when people can have a better life because of it.
And I'll link up to a clip because we actually talked about this on the episode that we recorded at CampFi. And it's fairly simple and you're very smart, Pete, and you've done this for a while. So like, it doesn't surprise me that you're able to like sort through the complexity and then help someone see things in a simpler way so that they're not confused by, you know, the noise and they can focus on the signal there. And I'll point out one other thing, because some people, you know, it's the internet out there, people will probably be like, why are you charging for this? You're retired, you're rich. But the thing is, like, if people pay for it, they'll value it and they'll come after they've done their homework because they have skin in the game. So like, I get it. You don't want to like waste your time and like give someone advice and then they completely ignore you because they don't put any value on it.
Yeah.
So, and I know a lot of people are like, well, I would value it. But the thing is like, unless you actually have skin in the game, it's likely that you won't value it as much.
Yeah, it's fine. Like it's nice to have a little filter and I just find it fun. You know, I find it fun when we make it more like a little bit of a transaction. Of course, I've only done it once, but
right.
I would still charge in the future for my coaching service.
Do you have, if someone is interested in that, how should they approach you?
Well, I haven't decided when to do it. So I'll put it on my blog, like I'll put it into an article or something and provide a link that people can schedule if I decide to do it. I haven't fully decided because I just... You know, it's holiday season. I got some fun stuff coming up.
Yeah.
Don't need any work right now.
It sounds a lot like work. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So keep tuned into the blog and you'll post it if it comes up.
Yeah.
All right. This one is from Andrea. She asks, you want people to build new towns like Longmont. Do you have any thoughts on where the quote next Longmont might be given how expensive it's become? So yeah, it's kind of expensive here in Longmont now.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question. So I don't think Longmont, where we live here, is particularly special. Like it's special for us because we have a really amazing, huge group of friends here and it's growing and we got the headquarters. But the town itself is just like a normal American city of 100,000 people. Like it's not particularly bike friendly. They keep expanding the roads. There's like these major sort of 4-to-6-lane, what I call super highways running through the town and there's like no traffic enforcement. So it's a bit of a Mad Max zoo, but that's actually kind of interesting because if you can still bike and enjoy your life here in Longmont, like I still do 99% bike transportation. I biked here to get to your house. Then you can do it in most American cities. And I've always done this, like wherever I live and in a bunch of other countries too. I just bike around cities. I remember doing it in New York in the winter with a friend and we totally got around. It was way faster than the taxis and even the subways. So most people just discount the idea of anything other than car transportation as an excuse, and you can still do fine. And the reason is because the roads you're on with your car are not the same things you're going to be taking with your bike to get around. So of course, when you're on the big car roads, you're like, oh, this place is so bike unfriendly, you'd just get mowed down. But you wouldn't be on those same roads with your bike. There's always another way to get somewhere.
Okay.
So yeah, I wish Longmont were a bit more pedestrian and bike friendly. And there's some people in the city council that genuinely care, but man, we could do much, much better. Yeah. I really admire people who work as advocates to try to get their towns to improve a little bit.
And yeah, we were chatting before and I guess we probably talked about it, but yeah, I'm not comfortable riding my bike on most roads, but actually to your point, a couple times I rode to HQ. And yeah, I don't have to ride on Main Street. Like there's a couple side streets and I was like, oh, this is like a nice neighborhood. Like there's big trees. It's very quiet. I hardly saw any cars. I needed to cross like one sort of busier road, third street or third avenue or whatever. But other than that, yeah, I was like pretty much in neighborhoods. There's a lot of greenways and I'm right off the greenway. So the challenge is like, there's only certain places you can get to conveniently, but I think for me, it's just like being a little more comfortable. Like, right, I need a more comfortable seat too. Like maybe you could look at me.
Well, here's the thing. Biking is a skill and most Americans are simply drivers and they're driving is a skill too.
Yeah.
You know, if you just start driving, it would be hard and you have to have like license and insurance and everybody coming at it from scratch, they'd be like, whoa, this is incredibly hard. How do you do this? But if you just try it, and it's really nice to bike with an experienced biker. Like sometimes I'll take people on group rides to get them comfortable with stuff that they haven't done. Mm-hmm. And then the next time they can do that ride fairly easily. And then there's this whole little bit of skill you got to develop. Like, how do you have a good bike that is trouble-free, and you need to have lights that are just on the bike. So you press on when you're riding, that makes you safer. It helps you ride at night. And you have to make sure like you have an air pump, because a lot of people just stop biking for a decade because they get the air gradually leaks out of their bike tire. And they're like, oh, well, I guess I'll just take the F-350 every day to go to get my coffee. It's just as easy. So like the threshold is all mixed up, right? If you put a tiny bit of work into biking, man, like I'd love to ride with you around Longmont so you can get comfortable, because I have a feeling like you're an athletic guy. You'd have no problem biking the same amount that I do. It's just that you're not in the habit and I'm in the habit.
Yeah. And it's just, well, I was going to say the other thing is, did you ride your e-bike over today? Is that right too?
I did, but okay. Just because I was in a rush.
Okay. When I was like that would help a little bit too, like for longer distances.
Oh,
if
yeah.
I'm like, you know what? I don't mind. Like I'm not in a rush, but at the same time, I'm like, all right, is it going to take like an hour to ride my bike over there? Or is it like whatever, 20 minutes? So
I totally recommend that actually. If someone's not an experienced biker, just start with a pre-made electric bike from any of the manufacturers. Like the brand Electric is one, or Rad Power Bikes is another one. Ride One Up is maybe the best.
Okay.
Because then the bike is all set up for you. It's got lights built in. It's all high quality. It's usually pretty durable, tires and everything, so it'll never get flats. And it also gives you a boost whenever you want it. So it's like a car, but you don't need a license or insurance. And then, yeah, I think that's really, really great. E-bikes have changed. They didn't really exist when I started riding. Now they're just everywhere, and they outsell regular bikes, and they outsell cars, even in the United States.
Whoa, that's crazy.
So definitely just to keep it simple, look for a Ride One Up brand e-bike.
Okay.
If anyone's looking for a bike, or I'm not sponsored by them, but, or go to a bike shop and they'll have some good ones too. But usually for like $1,000 to $1,500, you get something that will outperform a car in terms of getting you around town, and you're going to get in shape and have a happier life because of it.
Next question from producer Chris, and Chris has a blog. We'll link up to it in the show notes here as well. He's just getting started, so check it out. There should be some more stuff coming soon. So what are your thoughts on the cul-de-sac model, and have you brought any ideas back to Longmont from your time down there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I spent 4 months last winter living in this experimental new apartment complex that bills itself as a car-free community or even a town. It's kind of nice. It's set up like a campus, and they're still building it. But the idea is that most of the people who live there don't have cars, and they have very minimal parking. And the idea is they give you an e-bike as part of your lease. And it's also right on a light rail station. And there's also like a really nice car share system built right into the neighborhood, where you just walk up with your phone, these nice electric cars unlock, and you just drive away. So you really do have a car, but you just don't have to pay for it other than the super nominal hourly fee, which includes like the free electricity for the car. So that's a really great model. I think every apartment complex and neighborhood should be built that way. It doesn't have to be as hardcore as cul-de-sac, which is very anti-car, you know, because it's like part of the fun ideology there. They're like, we're going to beat the system. But the real idea is just like, let's make things a balance where it's not entirely assuming that you're going to drive for 100% of your trips. In exchange, you get a lot of the space back from what you would have wasted building parking lots and parking garages just to house these things that we don't really need to have as many of, these cars. And yeah, cul-de-sac is really beautiful, and I'm really happy that they're fighting to do this new thing. It gets a lot of positive news coverage because of it. So what do I bring back from my own life? I think it's not really going to change the way I do things. I just like the idea of supporting projects like that. There's a new one that just got announced called Esmeralda. It's going to be in Northern California, like way north of San Francisco. And that will be a car light rather than car free neighborhood. But it's another great thing. Like the more of these that get thought of and built, the more it's going to get into the public consciousness. And then I just want Americans to realize like a car is a great thing for certain uses, but it's not a useful thing for like going to Starbucks and going through a drive through or whatever. Like cars should be for intercity fun trips, you know, to go visit your friends or go out on a hike or whatever.
And we had a great time when we were in Cul-de-sac. Everyone was super cool, and it was, you know, great for you to host us down there too. So a lot of fun. The few of us went down there. Sort of observation, there was another question kind of related to, you know, Longmont and like having a walkable town and all that. So where I live, so I have an F-150, and we talk about it in the sound check. People can listen to it. It's a V8. It's the worst thing I could do. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Pete, but very I bought sweet. It a long time ago. So it's like
never too late to ditch your gas guzzler. There's a MMM article with that title.
So the thing is, I hardly drive. So the rec center I could walk to, there's a bunch of retail that I could walk to. There's a Costco that I could walk to as well. Although it's hard to carry back a lot of stuff.
That's why you need a bike trailer.
I need a bike trailer.
There's a MMM articles on that too. Carry 100 pounds of groceries like it's nothing.
But I think like the place where I live, if there was a grocery store that I could walk to, like if there was a Trader Joe's like over there where the old Bed Bath & Beyond used to be, like that'd be perfect because I could just walk everywhere and I hardly drive. So even though I have this monstrosity truck that's way too big for, and I don't need it, but I'm walking most of the time. So it's like, I wish, like I didn't get that feeling from Cul-de-sac because there wasn't a grocery store right there. I think they were replacing it. Like it was moving out and coming in.
They definitely, they have a new one on site now. And that's a key thing for reducing people's perceived need to drive.
Right.
But the thing is like bikes are just as fast as cars. They can get around cities like really, really fast. Because they're not subject to traffic and they can go 30 miles an hour if you have an e-bike and stuff. Average speed of a car is like 15 miles an hour when you're going around a city.
Yeah.
So there's no compromise on speed. The thing is, a lot of people think it's either walking or car, but walking is extremely slow. Like it's nice, it's luxurious, but you don't walk somewhere if you're in a rush. It's just so slow. Like at least get into running shape, which you probably are already, then you can get there pretty fast. It's like 2 to 3 times faster than walking. But why not just have a bike?
Right.
Because otherwise people take their cars, which are not really all that useful. You know, the Costco parking lot is terrible if you're in a car because you're just waiting behind these like super, super slow drivers who can't even back out of their spaces.
Yeah.
Whereas with the bike, I just go, just cut through that whole insane hellscape, lock up my bike right in front of the door, go in, get my groceries, chuck them in the trailer, and then I'm just gone before... You know, there's probably people who are still halfway stuck out of a parking lot, parking space, you know, in the entire time it takes me to get my groceries and get home. That's how insane Costco parking lots are.
Man, you make biking sound so fucking sexy.
It's, it's just because driving is just so fucking stupid. Like, not all of it, but driving, like when I see drive-throughs, that is just the fucking most stupid thing that I've ever seen. And that happens even right in Longmont. Like there'd be 20 cars. And they're waiting at the Chick-fil-A or the fucking Popeye's chicken.
Yeah,
and all I have to do is stop and take 10 steps and get their food and then they're gone. But instead they'd rather wait on their asses for half an hour to do that same thing. Like it is so insane. So I can't even believe these people have the intelligence to operate the steering wheel and the pedal if they're not smart enough to figure out like you could get out and get your chicken way faster.
Well said. All right. Question from Kyle. What are your thoughts about the connection between the fire movement and environmentalism? Have you transitioned to socially responsible investing now that there are some low fee index funds for that?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a neat question that doesn't get talked about much. So I happen to care about pollution and natural resources. And that's one of the reasons, because I'm an engineer and I'm just like, see the numbers on the earth. And I'm like, why are we wasting this nice planet? It's such a, when we don't have to, right? So I care about that stuff. I feel like most fire bloggers and practitioners, they kind of just don't care about that stuff. They're just interested in it for the freedom. And that's fine because inadvertently they might still consume and pollute less just by spending less money. Although that's also why I'm kind of opposed to the whole fat fire movement, because that's like throwing everything out. Like, let's just consume as much as possible because we can afford it. To answer the second question, I think, the socially responsible investing is kind of a mixed bag. Like it's not all that, doesn't work all that well, but it's probably better than nothing. And I wrote a blog article about this. I think it's called like, ESGV investing, is it also more profitable? And so it looks into, if you just buy the Vanguard fund that has the ticker symbol ESGV, if you choose that instead of the normal one called VTI, you'll own slightly different companies, right? You'll have like no oil companies, and instead you'll have a bit more tech instead. That's basically what it boils down to. So you might be making a slight difference. I happen to buy ESGV most of the time nowadays, and it's slightly outperformed the overall index since I wrote that article. And that's mainly because of like AI and NVIDIA and stuff like that. Like the tech sector's had a big boom, the oil sector has not. You know, in some other time period, the opposite could happen. If you care about it, I think it's a fine thing to do. Just, there's also like some controversy around it, and people are like, oh, ESGV is woke and it's all, you know, like it's, and then in a way that might be a good sign, because I feel it's like a reaction from these other companies who are now getting less investment. And so they decided to target the ESGV people as being these, you know, these terrible liberal tree huggers or whatever. Yeah, I'm mildly in favor of it, but it's not like, it's not the perfect way to do it. I think even better is just to, you know, consume less fossil fuels yourself and make changes in life so other people do the same.
And yeah, we can go on and on, because I have heard people say, and maybe even from you, like you're really blogging about like environmentalism and just like conscious consumption, and you had to trick us by writing about personal finance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So. I mean, it really is a win-win. You get a better life.
Yeah.
If you spend less and consume less, especially less polluting stuff. But yeah, it is also a thing that would save the world if we all did it.
Mm-hmm. Last question from Rakesh. How do you maintain your composure when it seems like everything around you is falling apart?
I'd love to know what Rakesh is talking about here, because I don't think everything's falling apart. Things are fantastic, like both in my personal life and the fire movement, but also the world as a whole, and even the United States as a whole. If you don't get your information from the TV news or the politicians, you realize that things are actually on average improving quite a bit. So I like to look at things like gapminder.org. That's one website that tracks like the world well-being, things like childhood mortality and average life expectancy, and the number of people living in democracies versus dictatorships, and number of percentage of the world's population killed in violent conflicts. Like all that stuff is getting better over time rather than worse. And that's really, you know, what the most you could hope for as the human species. So yeah, we're lucky that that's happening. And I'm always an optimist, but we're also in the middle of a big energy transition, where one of the worst things it causes conflict and pollution, which is fossil fuels. Those are obsolete now, and people just don't even realize it. But like the cheapest energy humankind has ever known is solar power, and it's out there, solar and battery. You can build that a power plant with that cheaper than any other thing that's ever been invented, cheaper than coal power plants. We don't need nuclear fusion, even though it's cool. So a lot of people who aren't like engineers who've studied the energy markets for a long time, which is kind of what one of my hobbies, they don't realize how good we have it. So I think we're actually in for a pretty exciting next 10 years as this thing that has already happened trickles out into public knowledge, and people have realized, oh yeah, maybe there's a pretty bright future for humanity. You know, I mean, barring something really crazy happening, like big nuclear war starting or something, I think we're in for another great few decades. And beyond that, you can't predict, right? So things look great for the immediate and medium-term future. So it's easy to keep my composure in that sense, Rakesh. But furthermore, even if the world were going to the shitter, there's no point me worrying about that, because I still have only a choice of what to do with my own life. So I'm just going to make the most of what I do have control over, which is biking over to Doug's house to do a podcast. That's fun. And after that, my son's coming over to my house, and we're going to have a fantastic afternoon. And, you know, then we're going to go for a walk in the forest. And that's what human being alive is really about, is making the most of your days and not worrying about stuff you can't control.
I think that's a perfect ending. Pete, this has been amazing. Do you have any sort of final words, or is that a good period?
I think it's a great ending. I just want to put in a plug for my bootcamp email series. If the listeners aren't already members, just go to my website and you'll see a place. You have to go on the desktop version, actually, because we have currently a problem with the mobile version where you can't see the sign up box. But go to MrMoneyMustache.com, join the bootcamp. You'll get the 52 weeks of once a week useful emails on all the best stuff that I've written over the last 10 years. And that's kind of my main way of sharing with the world right now, unless you're hardcore and just want to read all the 500 articles, which is even better.
Right.
But that's all I ask from people.
All right. Well, thanks, Pete. And yeah, I think we should be able to maybe convince you to come back on and, well, convince me to get an EV or something like that. I don't know. There's a lot of topics we could jump off to, but it's been a pleasure. Yeah, we'll link up so people could find all your stuff.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Before I send it to the sound check, I have a quick message from our friend Kristen Knapp. So I'm going to roll that and then we'll do the sound check afterwards. And thanks for checking out this episode. All right, I'm on here with Kristen from Five Friends Travel. Kristen, you got a trip coming up and it's kind of limited. So can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so I launched this just because like I love to travel and I love hanging out with five people. So I thought, why not combine my two favorite things, right? So I've created this way for the five community to travel together, to see the world together. And my very first trip is going to be to Portugal in April. It's 6 nights and it is launched. We have 6 spots left. If you want to learn more about it, you can go to fivefriendstravel.com. You can sign up for my newsletter there, which will give you updates and also let you know when more trips launch. And also, I will just give you a quick little foreshadow here. We do have some more trips coming up. I'm working on putting together maybe like a 10 or 12 day trip to Morocco for fall, thinking October 2025. And then already launched, because they sell out early, a December 2025 European river cruise to do the Christmas market. So I know a lot of people are excited about that. It's a really special thing.
Very cool. Like what sort of quality or what level is this? Is this like a really like high end? Is this really low end? Like what should people expect with the accommodations?
This is not like Intensify, right? This isn't like hours and hours and hours of programming and making you think through your FI plan and crunch numbers. This is not that. As a matter of fact, I'm not doing any programming at all because we're there to travel together. This is about creating memories, creating those memory dividends, right, that we talk about. And also, if you get a group of five people together and you're in a van for 2 or 3 hours driving between cities, I mean, let's be real, these conversations are going to happen anyway. So I didn't feel like there was the need to take time out. You know, we're this exotic place somewhere on the other side of the world. I'm not taking time out to let's sit in a room and talk about, you know, our investment strategy. Right. No. We're going to see the world together, and that's the point, is that this is for people who love hanging out with their five friends and who also love to travel, and this is just a way to be able to do those things together.
We'll link up so people can find it, and that's over at fivefriendstravel.com, right?
Yes.
Very good. Well, thanks, Kristen.
Thank you.
My current car, Pete, is it's a truck. It's a V8 truck. It's everything that I think you're against, but recently I looked at a Chevy Volt. Are you familiar with these Chevy Volts?
Yeah, the Volt and the Bolt, not to be confused.
Right. So the Volt, my neighbor had one and it's discontinued, but it's a plug-in hybrid And I almost got it, but I was like, I'm not really sure. It's kind of a spur of the moment thing. So I was like, I'll probably pass on it this time, but I look seriously. And do you have any impressions on the Volt? Have you looked at them in the past?
Oh yeah. Lots of friends have those, especially before the Bolt came out. And so for our listeners, the Volt is like a sedan. It's a plug-in hybrid. So runs on gas or electric, but you never have to use gas if you make sure you charge it most of the time. And yeah, they're great cars. The Bolt is better because it's a newer technology and it's also a hatchback and it's more upright and more roomy.
Right.
And right now in the used market, they're both super great deal. So yeah, I think hopefully you do end up with one of those.
Yeah.
And put a trailer hitch on it and then you don't even need your pickup truck.
Right. Well, and the thing is, like, at some point in time, I lived in an older house. So I was like, you know, maybe I use a truck occasionally. And like, we had part of our tree broke off. I don't know if you saw that. So I needed to haul the debris, and the truck was super convenient, but that literally was like the first time I needed my truck bed in like 4 years.
Yeah. And plus, you do know that as a headquarters member, you get access to our trailer, which is much bigger than a pickup truck anyway.
That's true. That's true. So yeah, the Volt was intriguing. And my neighbor, he got a lease on one of these Hyundai, like Iconic 5.
Yeah, Ioniq.
Ioniq.
Those are great cars too.
Yeah, crazy deal. I think it was like $150 a month. And then like it was only $2,300 down for, and this is a 2-year lease. And it was great.
That's a fun way to have a racy car with. It's like mostly the tax credits that are paying for that lease for you.
Right. So one thing, and I don't know if you ran into this, but this is actually like good information, and then we'll move on to the show. We could do the whole show on
EV
stuff. One of stuff.
My most passionate things to rant about.
So buying a used EV or plug-in hybrid like the Volt, you're still eligible for the tax credit. However, you need to buy it from a dealer.
Yeah.
And that create some complications, but through some research, I found there's like an online dealer that serves as like a pass-through. I forget the name. I think it might be Key Savvy. Mm-hmm. And you're able to, it kind of acts as an escrow as well. So it's like, there's a little protection for the buyer and the seller. And then you're able to pass through and get the instant tax credit because that online dealer serves as the dealer.
That's a good business model for that guy too.
Yeah.
He's getting a bunch of $1,000 like commission fees.
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing. So if people are in that situation, I can point you in the right direction if you email me. But it seemed confusing. I was like, oh, I just want to buy this car from my neighbor. I could just write him a check. Very easy and simple. But I was like, oh, if I want the tax credit, which is like $4,000 for a used car under $25,000 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be worth it if you want to save a few dollars and you don't mind some hassle. But I'll just throw in my little word here is don't get plug-in hybrids if you don't have to, because real battery electric cars are just way better and you never have to get the oil changes anymore, the emissions tests, or how like maintain the gas engine.
Right.
And so they were a great transition technology. But the only reason everybody's not buying battery electric cars now is just because they don't realize how good they are. Like, they're just no compromises. They're so awesome.
Yeah.
I switched over in 2016 and man, gasoline is just so silly. I can't believe they're still making gas engines.
Right. Yeah. And riding around in your car and then Carl's Y as well. It's, it's so much better. They're very nice.
Yeah. And they're cheap. So get a used Chevrolet Bolt or a used Tesla Model 3 and then you're done with it.